I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome to the 2026 season premiere of Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. While we've been away, the Gaza genocide has continued, and the USA has bombed Nigeria. There has been ongoing EU-US-UK armed violence in Lebanon and Syria. In Venezuela, the USA kidnapped the president and first lady of the country with the largest known oil reserves, Nicolas Maduro and Celia Flores, and the shadow of full-scale NATO armed war on Iran has hung over the world. All that as the NATO proxy war on Russia through Ukraine has continued, albeit tempered by Witkoff visits to Moscow and the new US military targeting of NATO itself via the Danish territory of Greenland. Little wonder then that those from the collapsing economies of Western Europe looked uneasy at this week's elite talking shop in Davos, Switzerland, and not just because of David Beckham. Davos is now chaired not by founder Klaus Schwab, who stepped down amidst irregularities. The chairs this week were BlackRock state subsidy weapons to Israel billionaire Larry Fink and billionaire Andre Hoffman of Accutane Tamiflu drug maker Roche. Joining me again from London is novelist, publisher, playwright, filmmaker and journalist Tariq Ali. Tariq, thanks so much for coming back on. Happy New Year. I don't know whether it's jealousy or pride, but the Financial Times talked about tech titans with a ringside seat at Trump's second inauguration are now even richer. And I do want to get on to the important issues of Venezuela, Iran, Ukraine and Palestine. But just briefly, I mean, your take on Davos, a manifestation of elite power in decline, or will the World Social Forum, you might have been invited in Benin, is coming up at the end of this year. What do you make of this obsession so-called mainstream media have about Davos?
I think it's a combination of money and politics and power. Davos symbolizes that. The question we have to ask is why they bother to come. I mean, Switzerland and money are, of course, old friends, but why do all these politicians turn up? Why does Trump even bother? There are numerous other places to have summits. Thomas Mann's famous novel, The Magic Mountain, was of course set in Davos, but that seems light years away now that he could write a work of genius in this corrupt, rickety place which the media has picked up as something important. That's the only reason. Were the politicians and the media to ignore it, it would die. It could die anyway after this year's events. I remember coming to speak at a counter-Davos conference organized in the town while Davos was taking place about, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, and making the appeal that we hope that Davos as an institution dies as soon as possible. Well, we might be closer to it than people imagine.
Well, let's get to this year. I mean, the year is so young, and we saw what happened in Venezuela. I used to live there, I should say. Your TV production company had deals with Venezuela. You know Maduro. You've interviewed Maduro, who's now in jail in New York. Your first reaction to hear that to the news that the United States had kidnapped him?
Well, I wasn't shocked because Trump had been promising it for many weeks prior to that. They'd set up this whole show of targeting innocent fisher boats or, you know, tiny trading vessels in the Caribbean Sea and killing people and not saving people when they were pleading for help. They'd already done that. So the question was, which I wondered about was what the hell is going on behind the scenes. We now know that behind the scenes, the Maduro government was negotiating quite intensively with the United States, offering deals of one sort or another in order to prevent themselves from being invaded or the country bombed. And the Americans made it an absolute condition that they weren't prepared to tolerate Maduro in power any longer. So he was offered various things. He was offered, lots of money. He was offered a semi-palace, a huge mansion in Turkey with all his needs taken care of. God knows what else they offered him. They offered him Moscow. You can go there if you want to. But to his credit, he refused.
Do you know Delcy Rodriguez? Trump is actually at Davos, was talking about how wonderful the deputy, the vice president, now the acting president of Venezuela, is, someone whose father was tortured to death by the U.S.-backed dictatorships in past administrations.
Yeah, I have met her briefly in Caracas, but she didn't make a huge impression on me, to be perfectly honest. This was years ago. But the fact that her father was tortured to death is very sad, but it gives us no indication as to what she really is and what they're up to and what they're going to do. I mean, basically, it seems to me they've handed over the oil in their country to the United States. They could not defend Maduro against capture. The whole world knew something was going on, but it has to be said, the army stood by and watched him being taken. The Cubans who guarded him, thanks to Fidel's farsightedness, when he saw that Chavez's own security was very weak after the 2002 coup d'etat attempt by the United States, he said, we have got to get you guards all the time. That's when the Cubans first went in. And all these Cubans, you know, dozens of them were shot dead. In what circumstances? We don't know. Who shot them? Well, the Americans are claiming it, and it's quite likely true. But there's something about this whole episode that makes me feel we haven't had the whole truth as yet. And we shall see what happens.
Your colleague...
I'm nervous, to be blunt.
Your colleague at the NLR, the great Perry Anderson, has written about Lula, and Lula's been on this show, I should add. I mean, do you not think that Lula's veto of Venezuela joining BRICS sealed Maduro's fate in a way, and that Lula is to blame in some ways? I mention Perry Anderson because, of course, he talks about how complex the legacy of Lula is from his first term before he was eventually imprisoned.
I think Lula and Maduro fell out over the last elections in Venezuela. Lula was under very heavy pressure to insist that either the elections be held again or they say proof that there was no rigging. Now, Lula demanded certain votes to see ballot boxes from certain areas just between him and the Venezuelan government and a team from Brazil in private. This was refused, and Maduro got very angry. But, you know, it wasn't a huge secret in any part of South America, including in Venezuela. I spoke to lots of friends. This is for the first time there's been rigging. We know that. Everyone knows that. But no one's going to admit it because of the, you know, permanent fight going on with the United States. And I was very saddened by this because I remember I was with Hugo Chavez at the Miraflores Palace when we were waiting for results to come in on the referendum on the Constitution, which the opposition had opposed. And I said to him, I said, Comandante, compañero, what are we going to do if we lose? And he said, it's obvious what we do. We get out of government and fight for the next election. Very clear on that. So when this happened in the last election, I was quite disturbed, actually. But it indicated what had been happening in Venezuela for some time. I mean, their economy was in a mess, largely because of the U.S. vetoes and sanctions. And Carney, this Canadian prime minister who's being hailed as the big savior and the fighter for Europe, was governor of the Bank of England when Boris Johnson, the prime minister, said that we need to freeze the billions of dollars worth of Venezuelan gold that was entrusted to the bank. So he did it. And now they say, oh, you know, Trump is being undemocratic. Yeah, he is, and worse than that. But you people were part of all this, trying to squeeze Venezuela, isolate it, sanction it, pretending that absurd characters like Guaido were actually the legitimate president. This was never the case. And the former U.S. ambassador promised Machado, this slightly deranged lady who's won the Nobel Peace Prize for demanding war on her country. And they agreed to it, and Trump is still not happy with this decision. It's a crazed world we're living in. So they've been doing all this. So the government got weaker and weaker and weaker, and it's the sanctions on oil that compelled millions of people to go and search for jobs elsewhere, that created...
Yeah, it's interesting you say that what Chavez told you, because that suggests that there's this kind of honorable strategy, even as they play dirty. I mean, the New York Times reaction to it was America's gamble in Venezuela. Nothing about the fact that kidnapping was in any way a strange way for a supposedly liberal civilization like the United States to act. But do you think at least it's educated people in Western Europe about U.S. imperialism, the kidnapping? Because the Nord Stream pipeline destruction, which was the largest methane emission in history, man-made methane emission, obviously didn't persuade Western European publics. Do you think they slightly more understand the nature of imperialism that you've been covering for decades?
Badavshin, the question really is this. Why did anyone imagine that after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the big, big turn in China, that the United States empire would collapse as well? I mean, why should it? It was strengthened enormously by what happened in Europe in the 1990s. And it has grown, and it's now reached a stage where, worried by the global economic challenge posed by China, which is going ahead on virtually every level now, that they need to shore up their own defenses. And part of this shoring up of their own defenses is to take the loot wherever they can find it. They took Venezuela not because they didn't like Maduro or couldn't have done a deal with him. Trump said it very clearly, we need the oil. We want our oil back. So that was why they kidnapped him, because they found that they couldn't have got it back as easily as they appear to have now. And this game isn't over, because Trump is now fighting on too many fronts and taking on a fight with the Europeans on Greenland. I mean, basically, in the, you know, Greenland is neither here nor there, quite honestly. It's a slab of ice, as he told the people in Davos. But underneath the ice, they think there is mineral wealth, which they now want, which is why he's stressing, I don't need to take it by force. We don't need to use excessive force there at all. Legal ownership of Greenland must be transferred from Denmark to the United States of America.
Tariq, I'll just stop you there. More from Tariq Ali after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the longtime editorial committee member of the New Left Review, Tariq Ali. Tariq, I interrupted you just as you were talking about the bizarre attempts on Greenland. Arguably, they already own where you're talking to me from, Britain, the number of U.S. soldiers there. What do you make of these Trump attempts at peace in Ukraine? Because there was what has been reported as a Putin assassination attempt in the past month, an attack on the house there. Do you think Russia has lost a degree of deterrence as Russia itself has been attacked in recent weeks?
I don't think so. I mean, I think basically the Russians are in a very strong position in the Ukraine. They want certain guarantees, and among those guarantees is that effectively the Ukraine will remain outside NATO. And someone was joking to me the other day in a conversation saying maybe this is Trump's way of neutralizing NATO totally so that the demand for anyone joining it doesn't arise again. But jokes aside, it's a war that has cost a lot of lives. And essentially, it should be brought to an end. The Europeans have been pushing Zelensky for their own motivations. But, you know, there is an obvious complementarity between Russia, the Russian Federation, and the Germans. Economically, in particular, they should be working with each other. That was disrupted by the war in Ukraine, and now we have an appalling political social situation in Germany itself. So the attempt on, Putin's life carried out, it doesn't. It has the deterrent, but, you know, heaven forbid anyone should try anything nuclear, because the Russians have enough equipment to destroy most of Europe. And themselves, of course.
Well, ironically, Trump seems much more aware of that than, Biden or Trump 1 or previous administrations. But what about if it doesn't go nuclear, the dangers of Nazis with loads of weapons in Ukraine flooding into Western Europe?
I didn't quite get that.
I mean, is the prospect of Nazi Ukrainians with lots of billions of dollars worth of weapons another fallout once this war is over?
I don't think so. I think there is no way the Ukrainians could have fought this war without NATO. It has effectively become a proxy war, NATO versus Russia. But with the largest power in NATO, as he boasted at Davos not so long ago, we funded you 100%. We created it. Who are you to refuse us anything? With this guy and the United States wanting a settlement, which is obvious, I think they will push through a settlement, and it would be in the interest of the Europeans themselves.
But how will the Nazis react to that in Ukraine, these far-right groups that are in Ukraine? I think you've talked about
Zelensky. Sorry, what?
I think you've talked about you've talked about the far-right groups that are there in Ukraine.
Listen, the far-right groups have been used by the United States in the Ukraine since the Cold War began, after the Second World War. We know this. I mean, it's public knowledge. The people the CIA were working with in the what was then the Soviet Union were Ukrainian, ultra-right Ukrainian nationalists, as they were all over Eastern Europe. These were their obvious allies if they want to bring down the regime. These people have now been made very careful, and no one cares that they are politically descended from the Third Reich and don't even try and hide it, wear uniforms that are quite similar, celebrate birthdays of fascist leaders, their own and Germans. So we know that, but they are not in the majority. The majority of the countries remains different. If you read the writings of Ukrainian dissidents who are opposed to the Russian attack, but also very strongly opposed to what their own government is doing, they attack them all the time and say that if there were a new election, Zelensky and his gang would be defeated overwhelmingly. Who knows? I'm not in a position to judge sitting here.
Zelensky, of course, keen to support Israel during the genocide, which we think about in this region every day. I want to actually, rather than talking about Gaza per se and the bizarre peace boards and aspects of Trump policy, what is happening in Britain? I mean, I understand hunger strikers in Britain successfully changed British policy vis-a-vis Elbit Systems, an Israeli weapons manufacturer in Britain. But at the same time, you right now cannot tell me that you support Palestine action because you would face up to 14 years in prison. That's the state of affairs in Britain now.
Yeah, I think basically they're under, the government is under heavy pressure on this question of what they did, declaring Palestine Action a terrorist organization. It's crazy. Believe it or not, a White House spokesperson denounced this as a breach of civil liberties on Britain's part. So there's very little support, even from their friends and allies. And in the country, a majority of the country is opposed to it. I mean, they can see what the young people are doing. And it's very moving seeing how many old people have come out, old age pensioners in their wheelchairs, on their crutches, carrying placards saying, I support Palestine Action, I oppose genocide, and being carted off very gently, it has to be said, in police cars. I'm told the police was opposed to this because they knew it was chaotic. But Trump Jr., cannot make any concessions. He feels he's already hated, the most hated Prime Minister Britain has had for a long time. Simplest thing is to say we made a mistake, we misjudged. But they can't do that because they've done it on every single issue. So the situation on Elbit Systems being cancelled, they say, I'll believe it when it happens. But the fact that they were forced to make this concession in public is, of course, a sign of how people are angry with them. They've now, the appeals court has overridden a trial that took place, a jury trial that had acquitted other demonstrators. In other words, saying juries are valueless. That's the other thing that's going on. So what is happening under Trump in the United States is happening in different ways and on different levels all over Europe, Germany. I mean, just appalling repression. France, demonstrators being beaten up in the streets. Britain, real pressure to try and stop the demonstrators or to target and punish them for carrying out political actions which are non-violent but very effective. That's what this world has come to, and that is the result of the incapacity of the Western powers to halt Israel in its tracks, which the Americans have certainly done before under previous presidents. Trump backed the Israelis to the hilt.
Yeah, and we don't know how far Israel is dictating the war on Iran. The Financial Times here going, help is on its way, Trump tells Iranians. I think, we've worked together, Tariq, on Iran. In so many different ways, I suppose. I'm thinking of course, the Salman Rushdie affair. But, and the war may already have started by the time this is being broadcast. Why do you think the so-called mainstream media in Western Europe will believe, I don't know, the Shah of Iran, the Shah's son? Bizarre ideas of history and politics intermingled with the NATO policy vis-a-vis Iran. Is it being sold well, or does anyone believe it?
I think most people mistrust the West on Iran in the West. But the fact is that the images which they got out of Iran, some of them were quite shocking. You know, the body bags and demonstrators being carted away in body bags before they sealed the country off. Look, there are two problems. One is an economic problem. Iran, like Venezuela, has been heavily under U.S. sanctions. This has affected the Iranian economy.
I should just say, Tariq, I lived there. Sorry to interrupt, but I actually probably am the only Western journalist ever to live there for a whole year. And it was working fine, but isn't the problem Pezeshkian in Iran, who allowed the currency to be bought in this way and manipulated in this way to trigger this bizarre uprising?
Rebellion. Yeah, there are people, and this is what I was going to say, Afshan, that there are divisions within the Iranian regime. There is a layer of people which wants reform, which wants to end the large-scale corruption which is taking place.
But the corruption is nothing compared to the corruption in Britain. I mean, come on. No. I mean, the idea. I mean, I lived there and I could see the corruption was nothing like the corruption you
but
have
listen,
in Britain.
What is.
And conditions for workers are better as well, I found.
But I think one cannot deny there have been several uprisings now against the regime. Not all of them have been caused by the West. I mean, the hijab fight which took place, on which they've won, in fact. I mean, the hijab is no longer made compulsory. Women walk on the streets without it. So sometimes they can get concessions. And I'm saying that fighting against the United States and Israel and their allies in terms of interfering constantly with Iran doesn't absolve us of the responsibility of being critical of the regime. It has not created a structure, for instance.
Isn't this why the genocide in Gaza happened? Because people started talking like this about the brutality of Assad in Syria and destroyed a huge element of the resistance movements that were there to help the Palestinians.
Gaza is a very different thing.
Well, it's connected.
Gaza is very different in the following sense, that effectively what we are watching is a continuing move of Israel from 1948 onwards to take the whole of Palestine, Eretz Israel. That's what they're fighting for. It's a colonial occupation. And they decided to go the last hog, thinking they would take Gaza by now, through this genocide. So what is taking place in Gaza politically is, look, in other parts of the Arab world, most of the leaders of this world are collaborating with what is happening in Gaza. They speak, but they don't act, including Turkey. That is what is going on. It's a big, big alliance with the United States. Even the Iranians were prepared to do a deal with the United States. They backed the war on Iraq. They backed the war on Afghanistan, hoping they would get some crumbs from the imperial table. They got nothing. Why? A, they're incredibly wealthy in oil reserves. And secondly, they have preserved their sovereignty, whatever mistakes they have made. They have preserved the sovereignty, and the US and Israel in particular in this region do not want any medium-sized or large Arab country to be sovereign or to even believe it's sovereign.
So we're out of time. Tariq, we're out of time, yeah. But Tariq Ali, okay. Thank you.
Okay.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US EU-armed genocide across Palestine. We'll be back on Monday from Finland to chart the end of NATO and the defeat of Britain and the European Union ahead of the US invasion of Greenland. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.